I really do think that the moon within our lifetimes will become the new Antarctica, you know, having these small bases. We could well see that happening. So fingers crossed, because I would love to go.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and the next episode in our series of solitude specials. In this episode, I speak to Dr. Beth Healy. Beth is not your everyday kind of doctor. She's a talented skier and outdoors woman, and she's worked all over the world on a really wide range of projects. The focus of our conversation is a recent trip to Antarctica, where she spent a full year conducting research for the European Space Agency, from Concordia Station, on the effects of isolation on the physical and psychological well-being of the overwinter crew. This episode provides an insight into the findings from that study, and it's amazing just how relevant they are today as we approach 2 months of being locked down in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. But the episode also gives you a glimpse into what life is like overwintering in Antarctica, the beauty of the night sky, and what it's like to travel for 3 weeks across the Antarctic plateau. Okay? So here's Dr. Beth Healy. Can you just begin by, well, the obvious question, who are you, what do you do, and why are we having this conversation, I guess?
My name is Beth. I'm a doctor. I trained in the UK. I'm currently working at Bath in the intensive care department there, and I have been just recently, and before that I was working out in the Swiss Alps. And the reason I'm here chatting to you today is because I overwintered in Antarctica, where I was working as a research doctor for the European Space Agency, and we were researching the effects of isolation on the sort of small overwintering crew. And the idea of the research really was to help inform us about some of the challenges that future astronauts on long-duration spaceflight missions might face, but also it's obviously become quite relevant now to our day-to-day lives, which I really didn't expect, to be honest, when I was down there in Antarctica.
No, it's funny, lots of things have suddenly, mountaineering, living in portal ledges and climbing big walls have suddenly become very relevant, along with hanging out in Antarctica.
Yeah, it's really funny, isn't it? It's like, I hadn't really even thought about it until we actually went into lockdown, and I suddenly kind of just got all these deja vus, and then I suddenly realised that actually it was just like overwintering, especially sort of in close proximity with people that you're isolating with as well, and some of the challenges that that presents. Because I think that's the thing about isolation, you know, actually when you're with people, you're not really lonely, are you? You just get just living on top of each other, which can actually be more of the challenge than the isolation itself, really.
Yeah, and that is exactly, I think a little bit later that's what we'll come on to in detail, because you can be lonely in a crowd, right? That's the and vice versa. Yeah, so how does somebody go from training as a doctor to living in Antarctica for a year?
Well, it's actually something I kind of fell into. I've always been really keen on my skiing. And that led to, for my medical elective, I went out to Northeast Greenland and worked in sort of a small Inuit hospital there. And I was also working as a sort of skidoo driver, doing sort of remote logistical support stuff out in Greenland. And I just got to know lots of people that had done lots of polar things. And suddenly sort of Antarctica got on my radar a little bit, and the opportunity came up to go down there, and also the research I found really interesting as well, all the sort of team and group dynamics of which are relevant both to sort of expeditions and also to human spaceflight.
Cool. And so you're working for the ESA, right? And what was their, I guess in slightly more detail, what was their objective and why were you sent to Antarctica?
So ESA have lots of different what they call like analog platforms, and essentially a spaceflight analog is just a platform which in some way replicates space. So there's lots of different types of them. So you have like underwater ones. So for example, in Florida, they have the NEMO project, where sort of astronauts and researchers go underwater for several days, and they are able to use the sort of neutral buoyancy that you experience with diving to simulate weightlessness. It's pretty cool. I'd like to see that one. And they also have like bed rest studies, so you can get paid to spend like 3 months in bed, and that's looking at the effects of sort of bone wasting and muscle wasting that you also experience in weightlessness when you're in space. And then they also have sort of isolation studies as well. So there's things like Mars 500, which was a study which was done where a group of sort of six people were sort of essentially locked in a mock-up spaceship on a Russian car park for over 500 days, kind of simulating a mission to Mars. And then we also have platforms in Antarctica, so, and that was the one that I was involved in. So Concordia station is used as an analog, and it has been done for sort of several years. And the idea of Concordia is the fact that the crew there are completely isolated for 9 months of the year, which is sort of the overwinter period. And that's what ESA are studying. So they're looking to see sort of the effects of that on the crew dynamics, the psychology of the crew, and also their physiology as well. And that's what I was studying.
So to deliberately ask some very naive questions. So is that a series of people wandering around in spacesuits in Antarctica in a simulated environment or not?
No, but that would have been really cool. Yeah, no spacesuits, unfortunately. No, I mean, there are some analog programs a bit like that. So sort of Mars 500 would be your kind of classic one where they sort of halfway through the mission kind of reached Mars and then did like a sort of space, you know, sort of simulated spacewalk in the suits. But no, I mean, Concordia, it's more just about just a normal overwintering Antarctic crew. We do have some sort of astronaut specific training. So we go to the European Astronaut Center before we go, and we do what's called sort of human behavior performance training, which is all about how to live and work effectively as part of an overwintering crew, and also, you know, essentially how not to kill each other when you're down there. So we do have some aspects like that, but it's really just to see what happens to the isolated crew. So we're not really pretending that we're in space, although lots of people call it kind of white Mars because it does replicate space in many different ways.
And what is life like overwintering in Antarctica?
It's quite long. It's a little bit lonely. But I mean, overall, I had an amazing time. I have to say, like, it's one of those experiences. Lots of people ask me if I'd do it again, and although I wouldn't go back and do it for a second time, if I could go back in time, I would definitely still make the same decision to go down there. You know, I feel really lucky to have got to see Antarctica in the nighttime, because while lots of people get to go to Antarctica now, I think it's a really sort of still quite a special thing to get to see the southern lights and to really have that overwinter experience. You know, when I was really little, I used to like look at all the sort of polar explorers, and there's something just a little bit exciting about Antarctica, which I always wanted to experience, and things like midwinter and stuff like that. So no, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm very jealous. It's very close to the top of my list is Antarctic winter. I think because it's such a rare thing, it's only generally scientists and, you know, people who are based with either BASS or whatever get to see.
I think that's one of the special things about it as well, is like, more or less to get to go there, you have to be part of a scientific program to do it as an over winter. That's not completely exclusive, but and I think that's one of the really nice aspects, is to sort of get to go down there and really feel like you're sort of contributing to science, and you're part of that sort of small scientific community when you're down there as well. And that's something special. You kind of really feel a sense of that when you're down there too.
Yeah, it's definitely purpose-led rather than just for the sake of it, if that makes sense. Yeah. So how many people were there, and what was the first week like? And I guess I'm trying not to go down the Big Brother house route, but it sort of is like that,
it's
you know, meeting
don't
everybody.
Worry, don't worry, yeah. So actually, like, when I went down, it was still the summertime. So there's quite a lot of people coming in and out of the station during the summer. There's lots of, especially like glaciologists coming and setting up their experiments for the overwinter. And Concordia is actually a big drilling station, which is all done as well during the summer. That's actually why it was built where it is, because it's got the oldest ever ice core, which was drilled at over 800,000 years old, which is like part of the EPICA project. So that's pretty old. So that's cool. So you get to meet all of those scientists. And I would say there was about sort of 150 people came in and out over that period, maybe about 80 on station at any one time, but not too many.
And what was life like with them? What's the, in almost the literal sense, what's the daily routine, and what do you get up to?
Well, someone that's really busy. I mean, there wasn't much for me to do in terms of the Easter research because that was all done during the winter time. So, you know, there's loads of sports. At Concordia, the French wear blue and the Italians wear red. So that's really practical for any kind of, you know, outdoor sporting activities, of which there were many, so things like rugby and basketball. So that's quite handy. You know, there were lots of kind of slightly trippy parties where it's kind of, you know, you're celebrating like New Year's and it's complete daylight because it's sort of, you've got the 24-hour sunlight. And also during the summertime as well, you have the Overland Traverse, which is something I got to do, which was really fun. And it's driving the big sort of Caterpillar tractors, like the Challenger tractors, from the coast to Concordia. And I really enjoyed that. That was something that was really special.
And what's the purpose of that?
So it's to resupply the station. So at Concordia, they had a few problems with planes crashing, actually, the big Hercs, because of the runway that we have there. So it's like sort of a snow runway. And because of that, they sort of cancelled that program. And now they only have like the small twin otter planes coming in with the skis. And so to bring the majority of stuff, it's all bought on a boat to De Monteville, which is a French station, kind of on the Australia side of Antarctica, and then you drive in a massive convoy, bring all the food and fuel and everything over for the overwinter.
How long does that take?
It took us about 3 weeks, but that was because we had an issue like halfway through. So I would say it was like 12 days or 2 weeks of actual driving, and then we had a few technical problems with tractors and stuff, so we had to be rescued a little bit with the planes and stuff. So in total it took about 3 weeks, and then I had a bit of time at the coast just like preparing, because we do sort of small parts of the journey. So we basically like bring up a little bit of the food and fuel up onto the plateau in the sort of preceding weeks, so that we don't have to carry it all up, because you go from kind of sea level to quite a high altitude quite quickly going from the coast. So we try to sort of drag a lot of the weight up before we actually set off, and then we sort of picked it up on the way over, which was cool.
It's totally amazing. I think there's so many people who think that the world is explored and fully mapped, and you know, A, that's not true, and B, it is still wild. I mean, you know, something as big as a space agency, a continent-wide space agency, have to cancel their flight program and use boats.
Yeah, it is trippy, isn't it? And it was I think that was the coolest part of it as well, because you just like walk off the track and like, you know, you just walk maybe like 100 meters in any direction, you'd probably be walking on a part of Antarctica that hadn't been stepped on before, which was kind of exciting for me. And also exciting for Easter as well, because we were collecting snow samples, looking for sort of extremophile bacteria that might be able to survive in these sort of untouched wilderness places.
Yeah. God, it sounds like a wild ride. Good way to spend a year. So what were the, on a personal level, and we'll come on to the sort of scientific side of it in a minute, on a personal level, what were the kind of high points and low points of overwintering?
Good question. I guess, like, I mean, high points, I guess, was just like the crew that you're with, like, and sort of some of the friendships that you make. And for me, a real high point was seeing the Southern Lights, and that was something that's really special. And just the night skies. I mean, it's really weird to just like walk out of the door at like breakfast time and you can still see like the Milky Way, and it's a bit trippy again, but really something quite special. I really enjoyed midwinter. There's something sort of fun about the camaraderie of the crew, and also in terms of the whole sort of Antarctic program as well, there was lots of communication between the bases at that time, which was fun. And the whole experience, I guess for me, like the traverse as well was one of the high points, definitely, sort of getting to be part of that and sort of travel on that little mini adventure. Low points, I guess, was when I saw the plane leave at the beginning of the winter, because it's a funny time, like the summer before the winter, there's lots of people that go down to Antarctica like year after year, especially during the summer times, and they're all like really happy to tell you about like how horrific the winter's going to be and how scary it is, and they're like sort of, get out now, like, well, you still have the chance. And like, it was actually really like you really spend all of, well, at least I spent most of that time thinking about, you know, is this a good idea, what I'm doing? And you have quite a lot of anxiety. And I would say in many ways that was kind of the hardest part, because at that point you can still leave. But actually, I suppose as soon as the plane like actually goes, it's not really something that you think about anymore, because you can't leave. So it's kind of relaxing as well in a funny way. But actually on the day when I sort of was waving it goodbye, I did have sort of mixed feelings about my decision and what I was doing down there.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that was a bit of a moment. And I guess it leads us nicely into what we're going to talk about for the next little while. But how do you deal with that moment? Because you have a few choices, right? You can crumble, or you can just, you know, deal with it and get on with it.
Yeah. I kind of had a bit of both. I remember I did have a little moment of tears when everyone was leaving. And I remember my boss being like, because he was leaving in that plane, and, you know, he was like, you know, Beth, like loads of people wanted to come down here and do what you're doing, so just stop crying. So I was like, okay. I was like, all right, just getting a bit emotional. But also it's kind of sad as well, because you form all of these like really great friendships during the summer. You know, it's surprising how, and you know, it's like when you're on expedition, like it's all a lot more intense than kind of normal day-to-day life. And so you do actually form these strong friendships. And so it was kind of a sad time to say goodbye to everybody as well, not just because I was going to be left there for that time. And also just from like a sort of vulnerability point of view, I suppose, like, you know, going down there, you're sort of quite young, fit and healthy. Like, I've never really thought about sort of my health before, and it was probably the first time that I was like, God, if I get like an appendicitis, or, you know, if something happens to me, like, I'm not going to be able to have sort of access to, I mean, that's definitely the doctor in me talking probably. But I think people definitely sort of modify like their risk-taking behavior a little bit. And it's the first time that I really thought, you know, what would happen. And also you do also worry as well, like saying goodbye to my grandparents as well before I went and stuff, you know, kind of not sure if you'll get to see them when you come back. But fortunately I did, so that's okay. Lots of mixed emotions.
I'm going to pinch a cheeky question in that case, before we move on, is, so how do you justify it? And it's an obviously loaded question. So how do you justify these long periods of time away?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it just kind of came at the right point in my life. And I was just like, you know, I don't know. I just, to be honest, like when I applied for the job, I didn't think I'd get it. And then when I got it, I just knew that I couldn't say no to it, because I'd always regret it. And that's kind of all it was, really, I'm totally honest.
It can be that simple sometimes, right? I think that's a nice thing for people to know, is that not all plans are grand. Sometimes things happen by accident, or it's a case of right place, right time, and you just say yes and, you know, ride the wave.
Oh, totally. I mean, I didn't really have that much time to think about it, really, because I was offered the job, and then it was, you know, and then I spent sort of a few months just sort of going around the world, really, learning about all the different projects that I was doing. And, you know, and I barely had time to sort of go home and say goodbye to friends and family, which I think was probably maybe intentional by them to really not really have the time to think about whether or not this was a good idea. And suddenly I found myself sort of on a plane going to Antarctica. And I think sometimes it's, yeah, maybe better not to think about it too much, or else you never do anything.
Yeah, think about it afterwards.
Yeah.
That's a good policy in general.
That's it.
Cool. So you're there to conduct an experiment on human beings, I guess, is the literal way of explaining it. And how do you go about doing that on a, you know, I mean, literally, how does that happen? What do you do?
So I guess the main challenge for us was, so I was the only one there working for the European Space Agency. So it's to engage people in the science that we're doing, I suppose, because everyone's like a voluntary subject. You don't have to do the science if you go down and overwinter there, because everyone's down there for their own different reasons. So you've got like the technical team that are running the station, and then you've got different scientists as well doing their own thing. So like glaciology and whatnot. So I guess the biggest challenge for us as ESA was really to sort of, yeah, get people excited about the science, and in turn sort of give me their blood and bother to wear all the sort of devices that I ask people to to wear. And I guess the main reason that a lot of people engage in, and the thing that we sort of try to keep in mind, is the fact that while all the science that you're doing down there is like directed towards long duration spaceflight, there's a lot of like clinical applications in hospitals at home as well, and also, you know, in lots of different other contexts, say for example on expeditions, and also now obviously quite relevant to our day-to-day lives, although that wasn't expected at that point. So I think it's trying to just make it relevant to people, and I think once it's a bit more relevant, then I think it sort of engages people a lot more in terms of the science that you're doing.
Did people see you as this kind of scary doctor who was watching their every move?
I don't know. I mean, so I was also part of some of the experiments, or all of them actually. So I myself was the subject, which I think kind of helped. And I wasn't analysing all of the like personal stuff when we were down there. So I was sort of sending that back to Europe. So it still remained like confidential. I think if I was like looking at people's confidential diaries during the mission, people might have been a bit more suspicious of me. But we tried to kind of keep that boundary so that I was just like collecting it and then sending it off and then sort of seeing it later. So, but yeah, I mean, I was the sort of doctor scientist, I guess. So yeah. People sort of running away from me when I'm like coming at them with trying to get a blood sample or something. But I mean, overall, I must give like credit to my crew. They were great, you know, and they did all participate for the whole period, even at the more tricky parts, you know, sort of during the sort of middle of the winter when everyone's really tired and the last thing they want to do is, you know, talk to my computer diary about how they're feeling. But people did, and that also gave the most interesting sort of research and results, because, you know, if you just get it at the beginning when everyone's keen and motivated, it doesn't really tell you so much. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's like anything, right? I mean, that's like filmmaking on expeditions. when people start shouting at you, swearing at you and telling you to turn the camera off that you absolutely don't.
Yeah.
You know, obviously there's a line, but generally that's where the magic happens.
No, totally. Yeah, I bet it's really similar.
I know it's obviously incredibly complex, but in terms of subject headings, what were you hoping to ascertain and understand?
So as a platform, every year there's kind of a slightly different theme about what we're looking at. So I'm, you know, it's sort of been a project which is going on for the last few years at Concordia. So looking at lots of different things. For my year in particular, things that we were looking at the acclimatization to altitude. So sort of chronic low level hypoxia that you experience because we're at altitude at Dome Charlie, which is where we were situated. We were looking at sort of group interactions, team dynamics, and how that was changing over time, and really looking for sort of critical time points and missions where people might be more or less likely to isolate themselves. And we were doing that with activity watches, which were able to sort of work out where people were on the station and who they were spending time with. So a little bit like Big Brother. we were doing sort of a lot of tech development, so things like doing sort of video diaries by developing, and the idea of doing that was to develop sort of computer technology which is able to look at non-verbal cues, so trying to work out what people are saying, sort of not by what they're saying but how they're saying it. And then sort of other sort of tests like cognitive testing and looking at how that's changing, sort of risk-taking behavior. Had the Soyuz spaceflight simulator down there, so looking at sort of training schedules and retention of skills. And then just lots of blood tests as well, looking at sort of biochemical markers of stress. I had a little bald patch on my hair for like a year because you had to keep on taking sort of hair samples. Looking for stress levels, and lots of other things as well, sort of the effects of artificial lighting on the eyesight. And we also did functional MRI scanning. And that was, you know, the big sort of MRI machines, and you do sort of computer games essentially inside of it, and it can tell how and where your brain is functioning. And we did that before the mission, directly after the mission, and then again 6 months after, to see if there are any structural changes in our brains. So hopefully mine wasn't too affected, but lots of different things, real variety of stuff. And then over the years there have been lots of other projects as well, so looking at sort of vitamin deficiencies and using sport as kind of to maintain motivation and lots of other stuff.
And to what extent were you involved in like the results rather than just the facilitation?
So I've been involved with sort of all of them, but I mean, so each of the experiments, they're not experiments that I designed, you know. Each of them have like sort of a PI, like principal investigator, and they were done by lots of different universities, by NASA and by ESA as well. So so ESA organized the platform, but then each of these institutions takes sort of responsibility for the design and the analysis of the study, and I have been involved in sort of the analysis, especially in the ones that I'm more interested in, I suppose. But I can't take credit, you know, it's huge teams working on these projects, you know, it's not just me doing it. I'm very much, you know, the kind of person that was collecting all the data and trying to be sort of Mr. Motivator of the mission, trying to make sure that everybody stayed involved. That was my main job.
And were the results what you expected?
So some of them still haven't been published, so it's a bit of a long process to get it all back, because also some of the experiments go over a number of years because we're such a small sort of population of 13 people during the overwinter. A lot of it kind of corresponds with, especially the stuff which is looking at kind of group dynamics and things. It really corresponds with the idea of having this sort of third quarter syndrome, which is essentially the period that people find most difficult and challenging within a mission, especially sort of documented within Antarctic overwinter missions, but also correlates, I think, a lot with expeditions and spaceflight, of course, as well.
Yeah, which I promise we won't go down this rabbit hole, but I've noticed that it's always the bit where that's like the third week is the bit where it really matters as well. Or the third week of a month, sorry, is that's where it matters. That's where the most kind of important moment is, whether it's a summit push or whether it's the hardest bit. And it's always the most intense.
Yeah, it's really hard because, like, you know, at the beginning it's like New Year's and everyone's like super excited and super motivated. And then sort of motivation starts to dwindle and it still feels like a long way away from the end of the mission. But, things get a bit more tricky.
Yeah. And so what were, God, there's so many places I could just talk about this for hours. Okay, we'll keep it relevant. So what are the main kind of learnings and teachings, I guess, that correlate or can be useful with what we're all experiencing now?
It's like a vast subject. I guess some of the things which were really useful for me, which I particularly learned from the human behavior performance training, which was all sort of evidence-based, based on the stuff that we've got from Concordia, the research we've done, things like sort of making sure that everyone has like personal space. I think that's a key thing. So we had like bedrooms as like a private area for us. And I think that was really important because I think if you don't have within your habitat, wherever that might be, even if it's like a small apartment, having a small kind of space which is your own and your private space is really important so that you don't feel claustrophobic. So, you know, even in lockdown now, you know, you can make like a little den for kids, or, you know, just make sure even if it's like a garden shed, I think that's really important for all of us. And even if you don't use it very much, just knowing that it's there, I think psychologically is really important. Other things that we did was to make sure that we had lots of things organized for particularly the third quarter of the mission. So, you know, lots of people during lockdown sort of, you know, my dad is a classic example, you know, he's like, you know, my social diary has been like wiped clean, and like, you know, people don't have things to look forward to. And I think that it's really important that even in isolation that you do make sure that you put these things in the diary to look forward to. So whether it's like a Zoom call with friends, if it's like a date night with whoever you're kind of isolating with, or even if it's like goals in terms of like sports and things as well. I think having that especially sort of targeted towards the third quarter is really important. And also to have some kind of tick features as well, so you feel like you're achieving things as you go. And try and make sort of your goals realistic, you know. Try not to put too much kind of pressure on yourself to do lots of things, because I think it's really important to feel like you're achieving your goals to sort of help maintain the motivation that you have. I think Other things that I found really useful was to kind of see it as a bit of an opportunity to take a step back from sort of normal day-to-day life and really sort of reevaluate things and what it was that I wanted to do in the future, and also kind of have the time, I suppose, to work towards those projects. So for me, it was to go and live out in Chamonix, and so I spent a lot of the time like learning French there. And I think having these sort of goals which go beyond the period of lockdown for things that you're looking forward to, I think it's really important. And I'm sure that lots of us in lockdown have like planned all these sort of grand holidays and things that we're all going to do once things get a little bit less restricted. And that was definitely the case for all of us in Antarctica as well. You know, a lot of us went traveling in New Zealand afterwards, and a lot of our time there would be spent sort of looking in guidebooks and planning this big adventure that we had for afterwards. And I think it's important to sort of look forward as well. And you know, astronauts often talk about like the overview effect, which is when they sort of go up into space and look back down on Earth through the cupola window. And I think, although, you know, we're not going to space, unfortunately, that would be great, but unfortunately going to Antarctica, or, you know, simply staying at home, I think just taking a bit of a step back from our day-to-day lives can be really useful to offer us like that sort of new perspective on what it is that we're doing and make these changes. And I get, you know, it's like, as you were chatting about, you know, sort of thinking about sort of climate change and how it's going from here, I think, you know, sort of stopping in our tracks, it makes it a lot easier to kind of think more about sort of how we're going to change than if you kind of carry on with what you're doing and then making these changes slower. I think it can be really useful. I've got a little list of things. I think my sort of trigger list of things. I think the other really important thing is to really keep it clear, like, why you're doing it. So for me in Antarctica, you know, I sort of had the research and I was really motivated by that. And I had it really clear in my head that why I was down there in Antarctica and what I wanted to do in that time. And I think, although we've not chosen to be in isolation, obviously, during the current COVID crisis, I think we can all relate to a reason why it's important that we should be doing it. And I think trying to sort of keep that as personal as possible is really important as well. So things like, you know, for me, it's like keeping my grandma safe, for example. And I think if you have that one sort of simple thing in your mind, the moment that you sort of want to go out and, you know, go to a big party or something, and I think by having that sort of clear in your mind, I think that can be really helpful in whatever it is we're doing, is just have that one thing that kind of keeps you on track really as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. And how good have you been at sticking to your own advice?
That's a good question. Yeah, I have tried to stick to it. You know, I think the other thing is to remember as well is not to be too hard on yourself when you don't stick to it. You know, if one evening you want to, you know, just sit on the sofa and, or a whole day in fact, spend in pajamas and watch Downton Abbey, I think that's okay. You know, you shouldn't be too hard on yourself, but I think it's important to try and kind of stick to these things. And I think I have. And I think, you know, lots of people say, you know, are people well suited to being in isolation? Are people well suited to being on expeditions? And I think, although there are definitely like some personality types that are more suited to it than others, I think that there are things that we can all learn and sort of strategies that we can all put in place which can make it easier for everybody.
Yeah, ace. Cool. I've got a bit of a curveball for you as a finale, and it's just fortunate timing for me and unfortunate timing for you. So on Instagram, on the podcast Instagram the other day, I shared a picture of the moon. It was just a really lovely high quality image of the moon.
Oh, nice.
Saying it was by Commander Chris Hadfield, and I just wrote saying it's exciting that NASA have said they're going to put the first woman on the moon in 2024. And somebody replied and said, actually, I don't think we should be going to space at the minute. And we had a really interesting conversation in private message. And then I shared it, put it out to the kind of Instagram following and said, what does everybody think? And there was a really interesting kind of debate happening in the messaging box. So my deliberately difficult question to you is, how do we justify space travel, which you are so closely linked to in lots of ways and obviously passionate about, when there's so much to sort out on this planet?
So good question. I think that, you know, if you look back in history, sort of any sort of exploratory goal, whether it's been, you know, going to the South Pole, North Pole, lots of different things like that. You know, I think sort of having these goals put in place is really a driving force behind a lot of sort of technological research and innovation. And I think, you know, for me, space is definitely like the next frontier of exploration in many ways. And I think because of that, you know, it really is a driving force again behind all of this technological innovation and development. And I think for me, that's kind of the most exciting part of it, you know, by having like these goals to go to the moon or go to Mars or you know, to go to low Earth orbit where the International Space Station is, it's triggered the development of a lot of really cool and exciting stuff, which isn't just relevant to spaceflight, but actually can be used in like our day-to-day lives as well. And for me, that's really how I justify it. Because I mean, even just looking at the research that I was doing at Concordia, although it was sort of, you know, funded and developed for spaceflight, I think all of the experiments that we were doing had sort of direct clinical applications as well back here on Earth. And I think it's just about making sure that there's the communication between the space agencies and also, you know, sort of the NHS, as it were, to make sure that this technology is being used. And there's actually recently been a massive drive towards that, which I think is really exciting. And I'm actually involved in one of the United Nations sort of specialist working groups looking at how we can use space technology to solve sort of global health problems worldwide. So we're really looking at like remote sort of diagnostics and telemedicine, and how we can use that not just for astronauts, but also for sort of small communities in developing healthcare systems to provide access to healthcare where otherwise it wouldn't have been. So I think, you know, with anything, there's always controversy. But if you sort of bear in mind that the budget of NASA, I think, is less, the entire budget is less than the budget for the marketing of BMW, I think that you can kind of sort of, hopefully, I think, justify sort of
is that true
of space travel.
That's incredible.
Okay,
you argued that pretty well. Have to get somebody
I think we've got to have these dreams and these goals, and if it inspires, you know, little kids to go into STEM, so like space, science, technology, engineering and math, I think, you know, if Tim Peake's mission did that alone, I think that that's important. So you know, I'm a big dreamer, so I've got to have these things to be working towards, and if it's space flight, then so be it.
Yeah, I can empathise with that. cool. So, bonus question: What is the long term plan? Like, if you, I know part of the fun is not being able to design it and not knowing, but what's the plan? Do you want to go to space?
I'd love to go to space. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to go to the moon. That's where I'd love to go. I'm not really into like the whole Mars like long mission, but for me to go to the moon, that'd be perfect, you know, a few weeks sort of round trip, perfect.
Just but, overwinter on the moon.
But seriously, I really do think that the moon, like within our lifetimes, will become like the new Antarctica, you know, having these small bases which are doing sort of research, and like that sort of global community of researchers up there. I think that we could well see that happening. So fingers crossed, because I would love to go.
I've never said this out loud. I've said it out loud in the walls of my own home, but it's my, when I'd like think about the pyramid of my career ambition, going to the moon is genuinely the top of the pyramid. Because I figure by the time I'm like 50, they'll need, you know, a sort of expedition cameraman with some sort of, you know, research background in anthropology or something like that to go and actually document everything that's happening. So I'm just working towards that slowly.
It's going to happen. I can see you there already. We'll go together. Yeah. We can go on the same flight.
Yeah, I'll see you there in 20 years. Yeah. Cool. Right. I guess we'll leave it there.
Cool.
Yeah. Nice one. Thank you very much.
No worries.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do that at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk or find us on Instagram @theadventurepodcast. And finally, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes, tell us what you think, and give us a rating. They really, really help.